This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neal Conan. Dennis Kozlowski, the former chairman and CEO of Tyco International, is in a courtroom in Manhattan today. He's accused of looting more than $500 million from his company. But he will probably be best remembered for the reports of his $6,000 shower curtain and $15,000 poodle-shaped umbrella stand, both courtesy of Tyco. With prices so high, you're not likely to find such items in every home, but these days, you don't have to be the head of a global 500 company to have a stylish bathroom, or a stylish anything for that matter. With candy-colored computers, turbocharged razors, minimalist toilet bowl brushes, and a plethora of potato peelers to choose from, the tyranny of taste has become the domain of the average Joe. But is all this attention to design and the surface of things turning us into superficial drones? Or is it giving us the freedom to define ourselves in a way that used to be limited by economics and a lack of choice? Virginia Postrel writes an economics column for the New York Times, and she's the author of a new book called The Substance of Style, How the Rise of Aesthetic Value is Remaking Commerce, Culture, and Consciousness. In the book, she says part of the proliferation of style comes from the pleasure that good design provides, but it has also come to represent an important source of economic and cultural value. This hour, The Substance of Style. Later in the hour, the United States officially rejoined UNESCO today, and we'll consider that organization's past and future, and we'll also read from your letters. First, is your deeper self revealed when you choose one toaster over another? How important is the shape and color of your toothbrush? Does the style of a sneaker have anything to do with its performance? Join our conversation. The number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And, of course, you can reach us by email at totn@npr.org. Virginia Postrel joins us now. She is the author of The Substance of Style, How the Rise of Aesthetic Value is Remaking Commerce, Culture, and Consciousness. She's with us from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
I have to say that I don't always ask people how they came to write a book, but I'm really curious in this case how it is you came to this subject matter. Did you sort of one day look around you and think, you know, where did all this consciousness of style and design in our society come from? Was that the...
Well, that was definitely... that's the easiest way to describe it. I mean, I am not a style writer. I am not a design writer. I am an economics, political... cultural commentator. And I just started to notice that everywhere around me, the look and feel of people, places, and things, which I call aesthetics and the substance of style, was getting more and more important. That you could not simply buy a trash can. Well, you can, and in fact, you can get a basic black one for $3.19 at an office store. But you have every kind of choice for what type of trash can you want. Or you mentioned toilet brushes. That there was a nail salon on every corner in Los Angeles where I lived at the time. That increasingly information technology, high-tech stuff that we had once thought of as, very serious for engineering types, was being used to create aesthetics, whether it was graphics, whether it was architecture, whatever it might. And I got interested in where this trend came from and what it meant for us.
And is it a brand new trend, do you think?
Or
how does it fit into the trend of the way people have always related to their environments in terms of aesthetics?
Right. Well, first of all, one of the points that I make in the book is that the desire for aesthetic pleasure and aesthetic self-expression is a very basic human desire. It appears to be hardwired into our biology, and no matter how far back you go in human history, prehistory, you will find forms of aesthetic expression. So in that sense, it's not new. What is new is the extent of the use of aesthetics, the intensity, where we find them, and also the variety that we have available to us, the number of different styles, the opportunity to personalize. These are new things, and particularly they're new in our economic context, and by our, I mean sort of the industrialized world. if you're in a subsistence economy, you don't have much opportunity for a lot of the things we now take for granted, transportation, communications, hygiene, indoor plumbing, you name it. You don't have those things, and you do tend to devote a fair number of your resources to aesthetics, whether that's braiding your hair, painting your house, that sort of thing. But when you get industrialization, as we did, say, 100 years ago, you have this long period of time, particularly in a mass continental market like the United States, where mass production, mass distribution, just having the stuff, whatever the stuff is the main form of economic advancement. We now have an awful lot of stuff. We've got quantity. And what we're looking for is quality, the intangible, the emotional quality of things, more than just getting a car or having a meal.
We also have to make a distinction. When you say that aesthetics are hardwired in our biology, that doesn't account for the fact that there's an awful lot of bad taste in this world. So we're not really just only talking about things being beautiful, are we?
Well, first of all, The Substance of Style is not a book about how everyone has come to have Virginia Postrel's taste in things. Pluralist tastes and pluralist styles are a big part of the trend, and that would include certain things that that some of us might think were kind of tacky, or just not me. I mean, there are things that I can appreciate the formal qualities of and consider good design that don't appeal to me personally as being mine. But when I say that there are things that are hardwired, evolutionary psychologists and various other sorts of psychologists have found certain patterns in what people like. And a lot of this research has been done on what people respond to in other people. Symmetry of faces, smoothness of skin. These are qualities that people like across cultures, across ages. Even babies respond to them. But there's a lot of play in there. One of the points that I always make is that people, one of the things that's hardwired in us is the desire for novelty. The fact that we get used to things for good or ill, both. It's good if you work in a smelly place and you get used to the stench, but it's bad if you have something really beautiful around you and you cease to notice it. And over time, we want to see something new. We want to experience something new. And this is the drive from which fashion emerges, not just fashion in the sense of clothes, but we see different colors go in and out of fashion, different hairstyles, and even I talk about in the book different babies' names, even though no one advertises babies' names on TVs, and there are no magazines that tell you that Ryan is the new Michael. We still see changes of patterns just because people get tired of the old and want something new.
Let me ask you about aesthetic value. What do you mean by that exactly? Is that an economic value we're talking about?
Well, what I mean is the value that people place on the pleasure and meaning that they get from aesthetics. And that is their drive to enjoy aesthetic, the look and feel of their surroundings, to enjoy aesthetics, and to express themselves with it. That's the source of this value. It has economic value as well, because when there is something that we as individuals value, and particularly in this case, value more relative to other goods that we might already have, it turns into economic value when you have a marketplace where people are trying to figure out, well, gee, what will people buy? Oh, well, if we make a restaurant that is not just low price but also a pleasant place to sit, they'll be more likely to come here as opposed to the guy down the street.
We're talking with Virginia Postrel about her new book, The Substance of Style. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 1-800-989-8255. And let's go to Angela in Oregon. Hi, Angela.
Hello. I guess I just had a mixed comment and question. I guess just looking at all the malls and looking at all the retail stores, sure, you see like a fuchsia and a mauve toilet brush, but really, isn't that just teaching the industrial consumer what they should like and not really giving them a true meaning of aesthetic appreciation. And that aesthetic appreciation is something that, like even master's students in design are still struggling with to really develop and understand.
Well, I think this goes to a difference in definitions and in to some extent in values. Designers know things. They know how to create meaningful and pleasurable design experiences. And I don't want to in any way take away from their expertise because it's very important and it's increasingly important, in fact. However, much of what creates aesthetic value is out of rational control. It is a pre-rational process where we are drawn to something or someone or some place for reasons that we may be able to understand after the fact, but the effect is immediate and it's not verbal or cognitive. And that has, again, there's pleasure and there's meaning. I'm talking particularly about pleasure. You just like this one thing and I just like this other thing and we can't really articulate why it is that this is my favorite color or that's your favorite color. Then there's also meaning and sometimes there we can articulate it. We can say, well, this reminds me of something that my grandmother had in her home and that I have fond memories of that, or this reminds me of the ocean and I love the ocean. I mean, whatever it might be, or my friends who are all rebels dress this way and I want to dress this way too to show that, you know, I'm standing up to the establishment. That's what they call anti-fashion, which is itself a form of fashion. So that I think the aesthetic value that comes from deep inside individuals from their experiences and from their immediate perceptual sense of pleasure at the look and feel of things is a legitimate and very important form of value. You don't need to go to school to learn it. Obviously, you can learn things in school, and people who have a lot of training in the arts, for example, will derive much more meaning from seeing the associations of different forms with each other.
All right, thanks for your call, Angela. Mm-hmm. What about the economics of this? Do businesses with the most style necessarily make the most money these days?
Not necessarily. Unfortunately, The Substance of Style is also not a book about how to get rich. It is, if anything, maybe a book about how to stay in business. It depends on how competitive your market is and whether you are a style leader, sort of an early adopter. Starbucks is my touchstone example. Starbucks is to the age of aesthetics what Ford was to the age of mass production, or McDonald's was to the age of convenience. They're the people who understood this early on, and they used aesthetics to create not just a way of selling coffee, but to create a multi-sensory environment. They now have to invest an enormous amount in keeping their design up to date and ahead of the competition, but clearly they have found it to be profitable. However, in many industries, and restaurants are one of them, it is increasingly just something you have to spend in order to stay in business, because otherwise people will go to the place down the street. So it depends on how competitive you are. If you think about graphic design, we all expect a certain minimum level of graphics that we didn't expect before.
All right, we're going to continue this discussion about The Substance of Style with author Virginia Postrel when we return. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK or email us at totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neal Conan. We're talking about the impact of style on American life. Virginia Postrel is the author of The Substance of Style, How the Rise of Aesthetic Value is Remaking Commerce, Culture, and Consciousness. She joins us from the studios at NPR West in Culver City, California. How important is style to you? You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Virginia, how did this, what ushered in this age of aesthetics that you're talking about? What are some of the things that led to this?
Well, there are a number of different causes. First of all, we've gotten richer and households have gotten smaller, so families have more money to spend on everything, therefore they have more to spend on aesthetics. That's the obvious trend, but really what's going on is not just spending more on everything, but spending, as I discussed before the break, we are devoting more to aesthetics relative to other goods. And I think that's just largely because we are sated with more. One thing Americans do not need, for example, is more food, more calories, even more restaurant meals. We consume an enormous amount of food outside the home. What we do want is a nice environment, interesting cuisines, fresher food, more tasty food, just to use a single example. So that's one thing. There also have been a number of technological and business innovations. We've seen the use of information technology, computers, and so forth to make aesthetic content far more available to people. I mentioned before the break, graphic design. When I was graduating from college in 1982, it was this big deal that I worked on the newspaper, and my roommate and I got our resumes typeset. We paid $20 each to the production supervisor there. Well, our fancy typeset resumes in 1982 are what anybody with a word processor can produce today. I mean, mm-hmm. They just had proportional font typing and bold and italics. That is something that has become very, very cheap, to the point that women who are looking for work cleaning houses put flyers at your door that have clip art, that have fonts that once would have been used only by a professional graphic designer. And some of them look like ransom notes, but some of them are very visually sophisticated.
Let me read an email to you that we just got, which is an interesting question, I think, Virginia. This is from Henry in Tucson. Tell me about the relationship between style and identity, the identity of the individual as well as the identity of the community. Are we being offered a sense of identity along with our style? And if so, who's designing our identity and what are the consequences?
Well, the interesting thing is that we increasingly choose our identity from a number by recombining styles that are sort of available in the marketplace. It's not as easy to manipulate as perhaps it once was, and this is of great frustration, of course, to people who worry about brands because they want to be able to prescribe it, but it really bubbles up more from the bottom. Now Henry mentioned designing communities, which is interesting because traditionally, we didn't necessarily think in terms of designing communities. Communities just emerged, and they didn't necessarily have a lot of aesthetic content to them. They just kind of grew. If you think of neighborhoods, how people build their houses. Then we went through a period of we've adopted lots of land use controls, et cetera. But most of those were things like lot sizes and setbacks, and this is single-family residence versus multi-family residence. What you're seeing today is increasingly not just private developers, but actually towns prescribing the aesthetics of their communities. And this is something that I understand the reasons for it. As people put a greater emphasis on aesthetics in all aspects of their life, they notice the things that stand out in their towns that they might not like, and they try to do something about them. On the other hand, it can be extremely constrictive and cause a problem in people being able to express their aesthetic identity.
Right. People want to be able to be individuals. Let's take another call. Kevin in the state of New York. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Good. I'm a visual high school arts teacher from Chautauqua Lake, New York, and aesthetics is a big part of my lessons every day. And I just more of a statement than a question, or maybe it does lead to a question, and how the lack of education in aesthetics, how it permeates throughout not only the United States, well, mostly the United States, coming from the United States, being myself, that it really can be a detriment on society in the long run, because as the kids come in, they don't know the difference between good or bad, let alone know the meaning of the word aesthetic. And I see this in the adults, too, in what we choose every day, from our diet to what we look for on television, that maybe that there are so many choices that we have a really hard time differentiating between good and bad.
Or maybe we're being marketed a particular kind of aesthetic value.
Oh, certainly, certainly. That we're kind of like lambs led to the slaughter. And I think New York State's assessment is in the high school level is a very stringent standards. And being a part of it, especially in the arts, it's a continual fight against the status quo and what we expect from our children. And I, being one teacher in a small school district, I don't know how many other teachers touch upon it in their own subject matters.
Well, it's interesting, Virginia, because Kevin seems to be saying something quite opposite, I think, or maybe I'm hearing it wrong, than to what you're saying, which is that people are not terribly sophisticated aesthetically.
Well, I think that people have gotten more and more visually sophisticated. Younger people are more visually sophisticated than people were in earlier generations, just from exposure. But that doesn't mean they can explain it. That means they can interpret it. But I want to make another point, which has to do with education. Traditionally, we have thought of aesthetics in one of two ways. Either it was that relate to each other. Either it was just without value. It's just a frill. It's not something that's practical. It's not something that's real. The value of look and feel is not real. It's not legitimate. That's one way. The other way is to think, oh, aesthetics is so special. It's this higher and better thing. It's the role of the artist who's to teach us and to be sort of higher than the rest of society. And what happens is these two seemingly opposed views actually reinforce each other when we come to thinking about educating young people to have aesthetic skills, because we treat it as a frill, or we treat it as something that should only be done for the artistically gifted. Well, let me tell you, they don't only teach the verbally gifted how to write.
Right.
And I think that there's a certain minimum level of aesthetic exposure that, as this becomes more and more a source of economic value, there's going to be more and more pressure for that to be included in school curricula.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Kevin. We're going to move on to another call now to Diane in Lafayette, Alabama. Hi, Diane.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yes, I was calling. I noticed that your next show was going to be dealing with poverty, and bringing these two issues together may seem kind of strange, but I became disabled about 15 years ago, and so economically I've sort of suffered. But one thing I have learned, and I formed an organization here locally, and we're trying to work with many issues of poverty and disability, but one of them is aesthetics, and I feel that one of the blights of poverty is truly the visual hideousness of being very, very poor, and that even best aesthetics can be an escape from this fate in many ways. I mean, I'm trying to work to help people learn that individually, within their own taste, they have the freedom to be artists and to control their environment visually the best they can.
How do you do that, Diane? I'm just curious. How do you instill that in for people who are grappling with basic necessity? How do you start talking to them about aesthetics?
Well, you're going to have things that you use. I mean, you're going to have things to sit on. You're going to have rugs in your house or whatever you have. Like what I've tried to do, since I haven't had much money, I mean, I try to focus on things that are inexpensive, like paint, you know, just buying, coordinating things. I mean, it's hard to describe very quickly, but just to try to create an environment that is comfortable for you, that visually you don't feel impoverished. Like you can buy things at estate sales or things like this, you know, you can buy things that are visually pleasing to you, even a few objects in your house that you consider really uplifting. Like when I have severe pain, I focus on certain objects that I have that lift me from that, to use your vision as a way of escaping the more dismal parts of life.
Yeah.
And it really, I mean, people come where I live and they're like, oh, this is so beautiful. And I say, well, this cost me $3, $4. I mean, they're really amazed at what you can do if you try to look at things where the quality of them, like form falling into the Bauhaus and maybe these other movements that have tried to use function and beauty together, you can do this, and it can become sort of a challenge to you, and it focuses you away from absolutely this is a bare necessity to this is something that I need, but it's also a visual pleasure for me.
All right, thanks for your call, Diane. I'd like to hear Virginia talk about that a little bit, the need for aesthetics, no matter what.
I think that's great, and helping people to learn how they can create aesthetic environments without spending a lot of money is a really wonderful thing, because I agree that the aesthetic impoverishment only makes poverty worse, and it's not the notion that poor people only need, you know, essential vital needs and not beauty and not pleasure and in their lives is
and
wrong.
even if you are interested in what they call sort of living simply now, if you see that magazine, I think it's called Living Simply, I forget what it's called exactly, but if you look at that, even there you can see, you know, that there's an aesthetic value to that kind of simplicity.
Right. I mean, it takes more work to create aesthetic value than to buy it. so that's what, you know, Diane is what her work is doing, is helping people learn that. The other thing that there's been some work done on, there's a group called Styleworks that helps women who are moving from welfare to work, gives them makeovers, essentially, helps them.
That's right,
Styleworks.org is their website. And that is very important for two reasons. First of all, when people look better, they feel better about themselves. They're more confident. They're more able to go into the workplace. And the other is, of course, it makes them look more, quote, professional. It makes them more desirable to hire. So I think that that's, again, saying that, you know, skills are important, work habits are important, but how you look and feel is also important.
We're talking with Virginia Postrel, author of The Substance of Style, How the Rise of Aesthetic Value is Remaking Commerce, Culture, and Consciousness. If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call, 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. You can email us at totn@npr.org. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're going to take a call now from Adam in Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Adam.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Go ahead.
I just wanted to clarify a little bit, or basically actually seek some clarification. I have a broad range background in fashion photography, graphic design, and now I'm more involved in interaction design and software. The thing that I find is a new, maybe not new, but within the past 5 years has become increasingly important, is the idea of a brand. Now, most people think of this as, like you said before, McDonald's and Starbucks, but it's much more than that. The modern definition of brand is not what you think of something, like not what you think of what it is you're trying to represent, but what everyone else thinks of that thing. And it sounds like all of the different words and phrases you're using, look and feel, style, elegance, aesthetics, it's all really just a part of what I see as this definition of what brand is now. And, you know, brand managers and within design organizations and marketing organizations are becoming increasingly important when people realize the importance of, oh, wait a second, so what we think we stand for isn't really what everyone else thinks we stand for? And my question is, in your book, how much attention, or do you at all, put towards that idea of brand in the modern definition beyond just logo and identity, which is a common misconception of what a brand really is?
All right, Adam, I'm going to let you take that. I'm going to ask Virginia to answer that.
Yes, people out of the branding world tend to want what I'm talking to be about brands. It's related to it. It's very closely related, particularly to the phenomenon that you're talking about. But it's not the same, because the brand includes things like, what sort of experience have you had with the customer service representative? I mean, there's nothing aesthetic about that. You know, things that are more functional. What I'm arguing is that in many different areas of life, people are drawn to aesthetic value, the look and feel of their surroundings, of the things that they buy, of the way they adorn themselves, and that they use that to create personal identity. Now, what does this have to do with this definition, this emergent definition of branding? Well, I think one of the things that brand people and their critics have not understood until relatively recently is the fact that you can only manipulate people so far. You cannot tell them what they are going to like, or even what meanings they're going to ascribe to things. And in the aesthetic world, this plays out quite strongly. People like things for their own reasons. They ascribe meanings to them for their own reasons. And this happens with brands, but it also happens with things that are not branded. In the book, I talk about dreadlocks and the changing meanings of dreadlocks. And, you know, the Rastafarians don't control that brand, you might say, if you want to talk about it in the language of branding.
Can you carry this too far? I mean, we see things like, you know, plastic surgery being done on television, and, you know, thousands of dollars being spent for things that shouldn't really cost that much money. Just as a last question, and briefly at the end of the show, briefly, Virginia, can you go too far?
Well, as an individual, you can definitely go too far. And what I'm appealing for, actually, in The Substance of Style is a balanced understanding of what the value of aesthetics is, and the fact that it is an autonomous good. It's one good among many. It's not the only good, but it is a legitimate good. I think that it's good that we explore these aesthetic possibilities. It has its excesses, it has its negatives, but it is on the whole something that adds enormous value to our lives as individuals and as a society.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, Virginia.
Thank you.
Virginia Pastrell writes an economics column for the New York Times. She's the author of The Substance of Style, How the Rise of Aesthetic Value is Remaking Commerce, Culture, and Consciousness. She joined us from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. When we return after a short break, the United States rejoins UNESCO. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.